Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Life behind bars isn't meant to be a pleasure, but most Americans agree that inmates should not die in prison while serving short sentences for offenses like drug possession or theft. But since 1998, dozens of men have died of treatable medical conditions in special privately run prisons set up to house offenders who committed crimes in the U.S. but are not citizens. The Federal Bureau of Prisons admits there is a problem with these facilities, the only privately run institutions that are part of the federal system, and in 2013 cost taxpayers more than $600 million to run. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Seth Fried Wessler has been investigating these deaths as part of a partnership between the Investigative Fund and the public radio show Reveal. He recently published an article called This Man Will Surely Die, which appears in the current issue of The Nation. Seth, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with some background. How is a non-citizen offender treated differently from a U.S. citizen convicted of the same crime?
So in the federal prison system, people who aren't U.S. citizens, who are convicted of federal crimes and classified as low-security prisoners, are actually very often sent to a different group of federal prisons. The Federal Bureau of Prisons, which holds about 200,000 prisoners, federal prisoners every year, has set up 11 separate prisons where about 23,000 people are held, all of whom are non-citizens. And these prisons, unlike nearly all of the rest of the Bureau of Prisons, these facilities are run by private companies, run by corrections companies like the Corrections Corporation of America or GEO Group or Management and Training Corporation. So they're this sort of separate part of the criminal justice system, of the federal criminal justice system, that's really segregated on the basis of citizenship.
Okay. And just to reiterate here, you said these are low security prisons. So these are not murderers and rapists and armed robbers.
So 40% of the people held in these facilities are actually there for a crime that's called illegal reentry or other border crimes. And these are criminal offenses attached to something that we've actually usually thought of and treated as a civil issue. So usually when people cross the border, without permission to do so, they're detained by immigration officials and deported. That's a civil process. But increasingly, over the last several decades, the United States has made it into a crime to cross over the border, especially after one is deported and then comes back. So now, if you're deported and decide to return, you can actually spend weeks or months or years in federal prison for that offense that as I said, we usually think of as a civil issue. And so many of the people in these prisons are held for that kind of crime or that kind of violation. And then others are held mostly for drug-related crimes. And so two people who might commit the same crime, one is a citizen and one's not a citizen, are then sent to two very different prisons. And as I found in my reporting for The Nation magazine and Reveal, the prisons, these separate prisons for non-citizens, these separate private prisons, are functioning under sort of less stringent rules. And I found really troubling stories of medical neglect behind these bars.
So you filed a Freedom of Information Act request and looked at medical records. What tipped you off that this was something worth investigating in the first place?
Well, actually, about 3 years ago, I was contacted by the relatives of the sister of a man who had been held in one of these facilities. And her brother had died as a prisoner, a federal prisoner, and her brother was not a citizen. And so he had been held in one of these separate contract facilities for non-citizens. And she told me, she claimed that her brother had been the victim of medical neglect, that her brother simply had not received the care that he needed to treat a treatable cancer and that he had died as a result. You know, I've been reporting on detention and prisons for a long time, and claims about mistreatment and medical neglect are not uncommon. And so I wanted to figure out if there was veracity to the claim that she was making. And so I filed a FOIA request to look actually much more broadly at the issues of medical care. And I filed this open records request. And last year, as a result of a lawsuit, I actually had to file a lawsuit in federal court in order to push the Bureau of Prisons to start producing records for me. Last year, I started to obtain the medical files, in some cases hundreds of pages for each person, of nearly everybody who's died in the last 15 or so years since these prisons opened, in these contract prisons that operate underneath the Bureau of Prisons and hold federal prisoners who aren't citizens.
And the number of deaths sounds concerning. How many did you find had died since, was it 1998? Is that as far back
as
you went?
Yeah, so the first contract prisons in the Bureau of Prisons system began in 1998. And I obtained the records of 103 men who died inside of these prisons as prisoners of these facilities. There are others whose records I didn't obtain. And what I realized soon after I started receiving these records is that that there were obviously very complicated medical issues emerging in these files. And so what I did is create a panel essentially of physicians to read these files and help me to discern what had happened medically, what medical care looked like, how it did or did not align with sort of basic medical standards and practice. And what the files reveal as these doctors read the files are patterns of real inadequacies in medical care, inadequacies that in at least 25 of these cases likely led to the premature death of men who very likely would still be alive today had they received baseline levels of medical care to treat treatable conditions. In only half of the cases that doctors felt that they could review, that there was enough information to review, did even one doctor think that medical care had likely been close to or adequate, had aligned with baseline levels of medical care. So there were real systemic problems that repeated over and over again, long delays in care, treatment that was clearly needed that people simply did not obtain. Men who were held in these facilities not seeing doctors at all, sometimes for years, and dying as a result. The files really tell the stories of the final months and weeks in the lives of men held behind these prisons that few of us have even heard of in the first place, and allowed me to tell the stories of a group of these men and get a sense and really understand how medical care works inside the prisons.
All right. So one example in the piece, Seth, is of an inmate who was admitted to the Reeves facility, which is here in Texas, with a positive test for latent TB. This means he has a TB infection, but he's not maybe actively contagious at that moment, not suffering symptoms. But that test is supposed to trigger some other testing. Can you talk about that?
That's right. So this was a man named Claudio Fajardo Saucedo who was locked up in the federal system and sent to Reeves on a four-year sentence for illegal reentry. He had been deported before. He had come back. He had been locked up in federal prison. He was deported. He returned again, and he was once again locked up in federal prison. When he arrived at Reeves, which is in West Texas, and I should say that, well, this is a national story, and these prisons are all over the country, four of them and the two largest are in Texas. And so it's also very much a Texas story. When he arrived at Reeves in Reeves County, he tested positive, as you said, for latent tuberculosis, which is not so terribly uncommon. But the Bureau of Prisons rules and basic medical standards for people who test positive for TB suggest that people should then be tested for HIV, because those two diseases, when people have both, can feed one another in a really dangerous way. He instead was simply sent back into the general population of the prison with a note that simply said he was TB positive. And very soon after his arrival in this prison, without ever having been tested further and not seeing a doctor in any substantive way at the beginning of his at his arrival, he very soon began to complain of pain, back pain, tooth pain, and then increasingly painful headaches that he would come back over and over again to the clinic to complain of. He came back in a 2-year period 18 times to complain of pain, and not one time in that period of time, in those 2 years that he was held in Reeves, did he see a medical doctor. In fact, he didn't see a doctor until his condition had become so grave and his pain so intense that he collapsed on the ground in the prison and was sent back to the clinic in the prison after scratching his face. The doctor was called, and the doctor ordered the medical department to send him out to the local hospital, where he was very quickly tested for HIV, and days later, he tested positive for HIV, and days later, he died of an AIDS-related brain infection. The doctors who I asked to read these files said that had he been tested and had he received substantive care from doctors who would have been able to sort of figure out what was happening with him, he very likely could have been treated and could have survived. In fact, the Bureau of Prisons itself, after this death, reviewed his medical files and found the same thing, that he had never seen a doctor and was nearly always treated by nursing staff, and in most cases was seen by low-level nursing staff, workers called licensed vocational nurses, also called licensed practical nurses in some states, who have about a year of training. And the doctors who I asked to read these files felt just simply didn't have the training to be treating a man who was becoming so ill.
Yeah, the licensed vocational nurses thing was a real surprise to me, and no disrespect to the people who are doing this important work, but these are like the folks that you might hire to care for an elderly relative, change dressings. They're not qualified to diagnose things. They're there to sort of, do basic maintenance, right?
That's right. I mean, these are folks with, again, a year of training who really are trained to act in a supportive role, to support nurses, registered nurses, much more highly trained medical workers or doctors in the provision of medical care. So, you know, as one former Bureau of Prisons nurse practitioner and now nursing professor told me, while nurses are trained to know how to respond to an emergency, say a gunshot wound, a licensed vocational nurse would know when to change the dressing on that wound. But these are the people who are tasked with the day-to-day operation of medical care in many of these facilities. One way that that's the case is that in these prisons, in these private prisons for non-citizens, licensed vocational nurses are covering night and weekend shifts. And, you know, night shifts in particular are times when real ability to respond to emergencies is important, because it's not in those periods of time, you know, that's when medical providers have to respond to emergent events that simply explode in the middle of the night. Well, these licensed vocational nurses are staffing those shifts. But the Bureau of Prisons rules for night shifts actually say that in Bureau of Prisons facilities, those night shifts are supposed to be staffed by nurses or EMTs who are explicitly trained to deal with emergencies. And so this is setting up a situation where patients don't receive the care that they need. And as you said, that these workers, licensed vocational nurses, are pushed into positions that they may not be equipped to handle.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Seth Fried Wessler. In partnership with the Investigative Fund and the public radio show Reveal, his story, This Man Will Surely Die, appears in the current issue of The Nation. It's about healthcare neglect in private prisons that house undocumented immigrant offenders. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Seth Fried Wessler. He's got a story in the current issue of The Nation called This Man Will Surely Die. It's part of a reporting partnership with the Investigative Fund and the public radio show Reveal. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Seth, as I mentioned in the introduction, these privately run prisons operated at the behest of the Federal Bureau of Prisons are not cheap, right? They cost in 2013 more than $600 million taxpayer dollars. But I suppose the Bureau of Prisons is, in fact, looking to save money by contracting out to these private companies?
That's right. In the mid-90s, actually, the Bureau of Prisons began an experiment with private prisons. The Bureau of Prisons, the federal prison system, had actually resisted privatization long after states and immigration detention centers had started to privatize more than a decade earlier. In the 90s, the Bureau of Prisons began down this route, and the idea was that private prisons could provide the same kinds of services for less money. In fact, they emerged during the Clinton administration at a time when the Clinton administration had said simultaneously had promised not to expand the size of the federal workforce at the same time that the Clinton administration sort of oversaw a rapid and large expansion of the federal prison system. So usually more federal prisoners mean more prison workers. But in this case, the administration suggested instead that if they could simply privatize federal prisons, they could both expand prison beds and also not add to the federal workforce. So the prison privatization experiment began in the late 90s. And several years later, these prisons began only to hold non-citizens. The logic, as recently as 2014, that the Bureau of Prisons has articulated for this, is that non-citizens who later will be deported, later will be transferred over to immigration authorities and deported after they serve their time, non-citizens therefore don't have to be, the BOP says, provided the same kind of re-entry services to help them return to their communities here that a citizen would. So private facilities with somewhat fewer services are an ideal place for this population. In fact, what researchers found way back in the last decade when they began looking into these prisons and whether they actually saved money is that when you include the cost of oversight in the BOP's oversight of these prisons, they actually aren't saving any money, that the federal government may be spending just as much on prisoners in these facilities as they do in their own facilities. But by the time that research was done, these federal prisons that by then were used almost exclusively to hold immigrants were a functioning part of the criminal justice system, were an integral part of the criminal justice system. And so as problems were identified in the way that these places function, problems that often could be tracked onto efforts by the companies to save money, to cut costs. As those problems were identified, it became harder and harder for the BOP to close the prisons down or change directions because now they're an integral part of the way that the federal prison system works. One of the things that I found in my reporting, I talked earlier about Claudio Fajardo Saucedo, who was never tested for HIV despite the fact that BOP rules suggest that he should have had. The BOP was actually returning every 6 months to this prison in Reeves. The prison had been the site of a major riot where prisoners were protesting medical care. And after that riot, the BOP began to come back to that prison every 6 months to monitor what was happening there. And every 6 months, the prison found that the BOP found that Reeves had, in fact, failed to comply with rules for testing people and treating people who'd been found to be TB positive over and over again, every 6 months. And every 6 months, Claudio Fajardo Saucedo would continue to complain of pain. Eventually, he died, very likely because he wasn't tested and wasn't treated. But these deficiencies continued. And as recently as 2015. Records I obtained show that in Reeves, the BOP actually identified mistreatment of people with tuberculosis as a problem in medical care. Yet the prison has remained open. And one of the clearest explanations for why is that it's now a major source of beds for a prison system that needs places to put people.
I hope you'll correct me, Seth, if I'm oversimplifying this, but all of what you've just described sounds like, I mean, funny math in some ways. We want to be able to say that we have fewer workers on the federal payroll, so we take a chunk of what would have been the federal payroll and we give it to a private company to do the exact same thing?
I mean, in effect, that's what we're seeing. That research that I mentioned that came out that the Bureau of Prisons and the Department of Justice released in 2005 actually found that. So on the one hand, the private facility it was looking at, a facility in California called Taft, was saving money because it had cut worker benefits. But when you add in the cost of oversight, it very likely was not saving that kind of money. So yes, at this point, the prisons are remaining open largely because they are open, because that's where people are held, not because they serve the purpose that they were initially intended to serve when the Clinton administration proposed the idea in 1996. In the context of medical care, one of the ways I learned that the federal government has found or sought to keep costs down in these prisons is by forcing the companies who run them to comply by, to follow a separate and less stringent set of rules. So the Bureau of Prisons has promulgated over the years hundreds of very detailed program statements that guide very specifically what their own prisons can do. So, for example, what kinds of workers work where, or what kind of medical care in very specific ways people are to be provided. In these prisons, in these contract prisons, as one former monitoring official told me, the fewer requirements that the BOP imposes, the less money those companies are going to charge the federal government to run. The idea essentially was that these companies could innovate new ways to do the same thing, but at a lesser cost. In fact, what I'm finding is that consistently these prisons are operating far below par, under standards, and people are dying as a result. One of the areas where standards are not applied in the same way is in the context of mental health. Suicide prevention standards that the BOP has promulgated aren't applied in the same way to these contract prisons. The contract prisons are broadly required to provide mental health care, but the specific policies that the BOP has developed aren't applied. And I found cases where people who were severely mentally ill and who eventually committed suicide were provided nearly no mental health care at all, and that mental health care certainly did not follow the rules that BOP prisons would be held to. And so men who had, you know, serious complaints were clearly devolving into dangerous states, and who should clearly have been understood to have been suicidal were largely left in solitary confinement and committed suicide inside of these prisons. I should say, I keep saying men. The prisons are all used for men. Women who are not citizens are mainstreamed into the regular Bureau of Prisons system. So all 11 of these so-called criminal alien requirement prisons are used to hold men.
All right, we have a little bit of tape here from the doc, that the reveal doc. And this is a scene where Dr. John Farquhar, clinical director of the Federal Correctional Institution at Big Spring, Texas, speaks with you and also with Stan Alcorn. First of all, just tell us a little about Dr. Farquhar before we play this bit.
Well, I, as I said, obtained all of these medical records from the Bureau of Prisons that these companies had handed over to the BOP. And the files contain largely the nursing and sometimes, when doctors are around, the doctor's notes from care that the men received in these prisons. And usually in these facilities, doctors were simply co-signing nursing notes or, writing very brief notes. But In this one prison, Big Spring, which is a federal prison run by the GEO Group in Big Spring, Texas, a doctor, the doctor we're about to hear from, was actually writing these long notes. It was very clear to me and to the doctors who read the files that he was intimately involved in the day-to-day care of these of the prisoners that he in the prison where he worked. And in the middle of notes that he was writing about medical care, about a patient's conditions, describing their vital signs or something like that, he would write these notes railing against the system that he worked in, making very clear that he felt in the individual cases that I was reading about that these patients simply weren't receiving the kind of care that he felt as a doctor that they should have been, and that he wasn't able to provide them the care that he felt he needed to as a doctor within the confines of the system he was employed in. So I went to find him in West Texas because I wanted to talk more about his experiences as a doctor, and we'll hear from him a bit in the tape talking about some of the issues that he encountered as the clinical director, the only doctor at the time in a prison of 3,500 men in West Texas, who one doctor described as holding up the whole kind of medical infrastructure by himself, trying to keep it from falling down around him.
I've always had a seven-day approach to medicine, and I didn't see anything unusual about that.
But he was unusual when compared to the other doctors in the prison medical files.
He was writing more notes than just about any other doctor in any of the other prisons. He was there all the time.
Whereas in other private prisons for non-citizens, medical notes were being written and medical decisions were being made by low-level medical workers, often licensed vocational nurses with only a year of training.
And then I started reading what he was writing.
Some of Dr. Farquhar's notes start normally by describing someone's symptoms or vital signs, but then they just go off, railing against his bosses, especially when they blocked him from transferring inmates out who were too sick to take care of in his limited prison clinic.
In one case, he wrote, "This man will almost certainly die," and that the Bureau of Prisons would, he wrote, "rush to find someone to blame, blithely ignoring the casual and repeated ways he has been dumped onto Big Spring."
There's times when I was critical. I'm a critical person, starting with myself.
You actually wrote at one point, "I feel bad for his shabby care."
Well, I stand by that statement. I don't know who it's about, and I can't comment on any single record of any person. But there are times when the care was not what I wanted for any patient, period.
That was Dr. John Farquhar in the Reveal documentary that my guest, journalist Seth Fried Wessler, worked on. You can also read his article in The Nation, "This Man Will Almost Certainly Die." It's in the current issue. Seth, we should also note, which is to take nothing away from Dr. Farquhar's skills or his dedication, he's in his 80s.
That's right. He's been working in West Texas for his entire career, or most of it, largely as a family doctor in West Texas, and when he was in his late 70s, he retired, but he found it boring, and he took a job in this private federal prison, and he stayed there for about 4 years, and then left in his 80s. He actually continues to work in West Texas as a doctor. But once he left, and there were certainly problems that we identified in the care that was provided at Big Spring while he was there. But once he left, I write about a case that sort of displayed all of the problems that that the doctor worried about what could happen if somebody highly trained, a doctor like him, wasn't paying attention, wasn't in charge of the medical care being provided to a patient. It's the story of a man named Nestor Garay, who was held in the Big Spring facility. And one night, as he and his nine cellmates slept at about 1:30 in the morning, his cellmates began to hear the sound of pained moaning coming from his bunk. He was on a top bunk, and they woke up and turned on a light and saw that he was largely not responding, that he was sweaty, and that he had wet himself. And so they called for help from the guard who was on duty in the area where they were held in a cell. And that guard called for medical help. And the person who arrived that night, anywhere between 15 and 20 minutes later, was a licensed vocational nurse who, as I said, had about a year of training. And as I discovered as I was reporting this story, very likely didn't have the kind of training he needed to respond to a man, to understand what was happening to this man. Nestor Gurai had a stroke, and he was, instead of being sent immediately to the local hospital, which everybody who I asked to read this file said should have happened, he was left in a cell for the night. And by the time he was checked on again in the morning, the right side of his face was drooping. He was making smacking sounds instead of being able to talk. And by the time, at least 6 or 7 hours later, when he made it to a hospital in Midland, Texas, the neurologist who treated him told me it was too late, and he died hooked up to machines, still shackled to a bed in the hospital. The doctor, the neurologist, and other doctors who read this file said that had he been provided that care right away, he likely could have been treated. He would have had a chance at survival, but by the time he got there, it was too late. I interviewed the physician's assistant who was on call that night. He was on call and asleep in Midland, Texas, and the licensed vocational nurse who was at the prison had called him to check on what he should do. That physician's assistant told me that the LVN simply didn't have the training, didn't have the skills to know what to do, how to respond to this situation, and that the prison companies, the companies that run this facility, had and essentially put people in jobs and positions that they were not equipped for, and that put prisoners at risk, and, you know, he thinks is profoundly unfair to the workers who make up this medical department.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Seth Fried Wessler about his article, This Man Will Almost Certainly Die, in the current issue of The Nation. It's a partnership with the Investigative Fund and the public radio show Reveal. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Seth Fried Wessler, who has investigated health care neglect in private prisons that house undocumented immigrant offenders. In partnership with the Investigative Fund and the public radio show Reveal, his story, This Man Will Almost Certainly Die, appears in the current issue of The Nation. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Seth, surely the Bureau of Prisons has some kind of sanctions for contractors that don't fulfill their obligations, right?
Well, the BOP monitors these facilities, and either every 6 months or every year, a group of BOP monitoring staff show up at the facilities to try to figure out what's going on, to measure whether they're following the rules. And when these prisons don't follow the rules, they can be fined. The fees that the BOP pays to the prisons can be docked if the facilities, if the companies that run them, consistently fail to follow the requirements. But what I found is that in the history of these prisons, these kinds of deficiencies that often repeat themselves, and as I said, in the case of Reeves, deficiencies that repeated themselves that led to specific deaths, that likely contributed to specific deaths of men who could have survived, they haven't led to the closure of these prisons. And in fact, recently, the only decline in beds in these prisons and the number of beds operating to hold non-citizens in the BOP system, the only decline in beds that's happened and since they began opening happened last year when prisoners in South Texas in the Willacy County facility, one of these immigrant-only contract facilities, actually staged a protest that became a riot and ended up so devastating the facility. Holes were cut and the buildings, which were made of Kevlar, these Kevlar tents were burned. The damage was so great that the federal government declared the facility uninhabitable and the prisoners were moved into the regular BOP system. That's what resulted in a decline of beds. But these conditions, the very conditions that spurred these, that have spurred this kind of unrest, there have been at least five of these riots since 2008 in these facilities. The conditions that spurred these riots, very often medical care, aren't leading to the closure of the facilities. So, that's what I found in my reporting to be the biggest question mark. How is it that these facilities can continue to fail to comply with basic rules and remain open?
Did you come to a conclusion about what might work to encourage, force these facilities to be in compliance with basic rules to guarantee the safety of inmates?
Well, I mean, I think one of the central things that I found in my reporting is that many of the basic rules that that regular BOP prisons are required to follow simply aren't applied here. And so why it is that we have a not only separate, but also in many ways unequal system of prisons for people who are non-citizens is a question that advocates are raising in Washington and around the country. But I think there's also another dynamic here, which is that prisons are becoming a conversation in the United States, and prison reform is a conversation. That conversation is taking off, and it looks possible that something could move in Washington, that for the first time, broadly, prison populations are beginning to fall in the federal system. But these prisons have been left out of that conversation, largely because they don't really fit within the normal kind of confines of issue areas. These are sort of weird prisons. They hold immigrants. So prison reform groups have tended not to know what to do with them. And immigrant rights advocates who focus on immigration reform, who might also pay attention to these prisons, have also largely ignored them because they have to do with crime. They have to do with the criminal justice system. So they've sort of been lost between these two areas of policy and areas of advocacy. And then the other dynamic is that the families of these men who are locked up are often sort of doubly cut off from their sons or husbands or fathers who are held. You know, prisons in general are difficult places to reach, and prisoners often very difficult people to contact, to visit. As a reporter, I've often found that. But these men are sort of doubly cut off because they're not only in prison, but their families are often in Mexico or don't speak English and have less access and less ability to advocate for their family members to make noise when their relatives die. And so until these records were released, men were dying in these prisons silently. Nobody ever heard about these deaths.
Has there been any outcry from the governments of the countries in which these men do hold citizenship?
The consulates of these countries can be a resource for some of these men, and many of the people held in these facilities do write letters to or try to call the consular offices, and sometimes those consulates are able to advocate for men held inside, but that's very difficult, and that process is very slow, and especially when dealing with private companies, when the consulate, say, of Mexico is not talking to a U.S. government agency, but talking to the GEO Group or Management and Training Corporation, a corporation that's running the prisons, it can be even more difficult for a consular office to gain access to the facilities, to try to figure out what's happening and to advocate for men held inside. And again, families who might be a key advocates for men held in these facilities are really separated in distinct way because they're often over the border. I called the relatives of a man named Jesus Enrique Zavala Montes, who was held in the Taft facility in California, and who killed himself in the facility, despite the fact that he had complained and there were clear signs that he was severely mentally ill. The prison knew that he had tried to commit suicide previously and had information that indicated he had been on psychiatric drugs. Despite all of those things, received nearly no mental health care and killed himself in a solitary cell. When I called his mother and his sister, they hadn't learned that he had died for months after his death. And when I called them, they still didn't know why Jesus Enrique was locked up. His sister said to me, "I thought he must have done something terrible to land in an American prison. In fact, he had been locked up on a 4-month sentence for illegal reentry for crossing the border after having been deported before." They didn't know that at all.
So the illegal reentry prosecutions are really interesting. In 1993, as you reported, there were 4,000 prosecutions for this into the U.S. By the last couple years of the Obama administration, there are tens of thousands every year?
That's right. In 2013, when these prosecutions for illegal entry and illegal reentry were at their height, 91,000 people were prosecuted for border crossing crimes. It's actually more people than were prosecuted in federal courts for drugs in that same year. And the crimes continue to be the most prosecuted federal crimes. They're rarely talked about in conversations about criminal justice reform. And they're filling our federal prisons, largely filling these separate contract prisons for non-citizens. The prosecutions really began to skyrocket under the Bush administration in 2005. Rather than simply deporting people who were picked up on the border, in certain parts of the U.S.-Mexico border, crossers are now automatically, nearly all of them, are referred to federal prosecutors and sentenced in federal courts first to what are short misdemeanor charges for illegal entry. And then if people return for longer, sometimes months, sometimes years, felony charges, illegal reentry charges that can land people in these prisons for a very long time. And the logic has been that prosecuting people criminally and sending them to jail will deter those individuals and others from making an attempt to cross. When the Government Accountability Office actually tried to figure out if that was true, if it was working, they found that the Border Patrol's methodology for tracking the long-term effectiveness of the prosecutions actually was flawed, and they couldn't determine if it was working. And men I've talked to who have crossed and who have been locked up say that the reason that they're crossing, the reason that they cross, which is to get back here to be with family or to work, to return to the lives that they've often built in the United States, that prison time is simply, one man said, is just going to slow him down, that it's inevitable that he's coming back, that he will try. And he knows that he may well be locked up, maybe locked up in one of these prisons again.
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who wants to know, are there other places in the world that deal with non-citizens in this way?
Detention around the world is certainly a thing. What is particular, I mean, immigration detention, that is, and around the world, immigrants entering into countries that they don't have citizenship are very often detained. What's particular about these prisons is that they are federal prisons that are simply segregated on the basis of citizenship. And that is an innovation, I suppose, of this country's federal criminal justice system, that we've decided that because of citizenship, people should be sent to different prisons that the BOP itself says have somewhat fewer services, and that policy requires fewer kinds of programs or in the implementation of fewer and thinner kinds of rules to regulate how the prisons operate. It's a strange part of the criminal justice system that's largely been left out of our conversations to date about how prosecutions and prisons work.
As we know, there are lots of people, Seth, who feel very little empathy for anyone who has broken U.S. law, including immigration law. One thing, though, that I think most people would agree with is that there's a public health component. Certainly an inmate population health component to making sure that everybody has been, tested for communicable diseases and treated for them.
I mean, there's some very baseline kinds of medical care that it's absolutely right that I think everybody would agree that no matter what, people should be receiving. And in reports I've obtained from these prisons and in other reports that have been published by the federal government about these reports, what's clear is that time and again, they aren't following those baseline rules. People aren't being treated for diseases like tuberculosis or HIV, nor are they receiving basic levels of care for diseases like cancer or AIDS or mental illness. And men are dying as a result. So yeah, I think there are many people who respond in various ways when they think about prisoners. And the fact is that these are men with families and with lives, and they're dying in these prisons as a result of care that simply isn't meeting even basic levels of medical care that doctors who reviewed these files felt that anybody should receive anywhere.
Why not just deport these folks rather than detain them if they haven't committed a secondary crime?
I mean, the logic is that if we lock people up, that if people spend months or years in prison, that it will act as a deterrence. What we've seen in this context, as in many other criminal justice system contexts, is that locking people up very, very often does not work in that way, that it doesn't work as a deterrence. Instead, it works to separate families, to create really troubling conditions in communities, to make it difficult for people after they're released to support themselves, to get jobs, to return to their lives. And in this case, we're seeing a prison system filling up. A crowding of our prisons as a result of a kind of criminalization that we really haven't talked about very much in the United States. We haven't really talked about whether crossing the border should be treated as a crime, as something that can land you in prison for months or years at a time.
Did you get the sense, Seth, that folks who run the Bureau of Prisons are concerned about substandard immigrant health care?
You know, in the case, again, of Reeves, of that Reeves facility in West Texas, Reeves, the BOP actually was reviewing whether they should continue contracting with Reeves County, which then contracts with a prison company and a medical company, because there had been so many problems. There was clearly concern inside the BOP about whether this was a good idea. They explicitly admitted in one document that I read that they knew that medical care was a serious problem. But at the end of the day, the decision was made to continue contracting largely because the BOP felt it simply needed the bed space. There's a kind of momentum that's operating here that often beats out logic, that beats out analysis of what's actually happening inside of the facilities themselves. And as I write about in this piece, men are suffering intensely in serious pain, receiving care from people who medical workers who aren't trained to do so, aren't trained to provide that care, and are dying as a result.
Journalist Seth Fried Wessler recently published an article called "This Man Will Almost Certainly Die," which appears in the current issue of The Nation. It was produced as part of a partnership between the Investigative Fund and the public radio show Reveal. Seth, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Tori Whitley. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.